Welcome to the Solari Food Series audiocast. This is your host, Pete Kennedy. On today's audiocast, it's an honor to have Sally Fallon Morell as our guest. Sally is the founder and president of the Weston A. Price Foundation. WAPF is a international nonprofit dedicated to restoring nutrient-dense foods to the American diet through education, research, and activism. Aside from that, Sally is the author of the Nourishing Traditions Cookbook. It's really a combination cookbook nutrition book, and I believe with no mainstream media advertising whatsoever, it has 800,000 copies in print. She's been a leader in the effort to increase demands in foods like raw milk and other raw dairy products, grass-fed meat, pastured poultry, kombucha, sauerkraut, bone broth. But on today's podcast, we're not going to talk about so much as the food you should be eating as the foods you should not be eating, namely synthetic foods. So without further ado, Sally, welcome to the Solari Food Series audiocast.
Thank you, Pete. And, you know, Pete and I have worked together, I would say, for 20 years. It's about that long.
Pretty close, yeah.
And it's just been a pleasure working with Pete and seeing the success that we have garnered with, especially with the availability of raw milk. When we started, it was not very available, and now pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, it's been you've been a great boss. but I guess when we start talking about synthetic foods, let's hit first what's been in the news quite a bit recently. Just, it seems like there's a definite agenda at the top to reduce the amount of dairy and especially meat that people consume. And there's been a lot in the news recently about this cell cultured meat. You've looked into it. What have you found?
Yes, and I think the agenda is to create foods that have a higher profit margin, because I would guess that the food with the lowest profit margin is beef. It's also the food that uses the least soy in its production. So there is a big move to get us to eat a plant-based diet. And really the most disgusting, the most imitation, words cannot describe this lab-cultured meat or cell-cultured meat, which starts off with some beef cells, beef muscle cells, and then gets them to grow in a lab. And they, like everything else in life, they need food. And so what do they feed these cells, these beef muscle cells? And the first, it's a serum that contains corn, based on corn. So a lot of corn has to be grown to feed these muscle cells. But it also needs something called BFS, which is bovine fetal serum. And the way they get the bovine fetal serum is when cows are brought in for slaughter, and a lot of dairy cows are brought in for slaughter, and they're often pregnant. So they kill the cow and immediately remove the fetus, and the fetus is still alive. And then they slowly drain the blood from this fetus while the fetus is still alive. It takes 5 to 10 minutes to remove all this blood. The blood is then manipulated in certain ways, and that's the bovine fetal serum. So this is used for making vaccines. It's used for lots of things in so-called science. And it's also used to feed these muscle cells. So the first thing to realize is there's a lot of suffering that occurs to create this cell cultured meat. It's not benign. They have to use antibiotics in this process, and also antifungals to keep, you know, scum from growing on this culture. And then it's manipulated in other ways to make the cell cultured meat.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is, you know, you've sent me to this food safety conference the last couple of years where they've talked about the cell cultured meat, and this has to be approved by FDA and USDA, and neither agency has received any application on what exactly is in the meat yet. So it's like they're almost reluctant to introduce what is actually going to be in the product right now.
Yeah, and what's involved. And by the way, they're trying to do this for cell-cultured chicken, cell-cultured fish, and cell-cultured breast milk. So they're trying to make a cell-cultured milk for babies. I mean, I just can't think of anything more disgusting or more fraught with problems than something like this.
And we've kind of seen them do the same thing with dairy, like some of the big dairy processors like Dean Foods got into plant-based milk, soy milk, almond milk, something like this. And right now, I think Tyson and Cargill have a partnership with Bill Gates and this company, Memphis Meats, to produce this cell-cultured meat. So it seems like, you know, they're working with an eye to possibly cut out a lot of the ranchers, the Tyson and Cargill.
Yes, and it you know, the production of milk, real milk, is costly, and it requires a lot of care, and animals need to be healthy and well-nourished, and that's a job for a real farmer, not an industrial operation. But these plant-based milks are a different kettle of fish to what they're trying to do with the lab-cultured milk. Plant-based milks are, they take almonds or oats or soy, and they manipulate this in certain ways, refine it, remove the protein, and this is a horrendous process that damages the proteins. And then they need to add other ingredients, often a sweetener, and emulsifiers so that it doesn't separate, and that's what goes on the shelves as plant-based milk. And by the way, Pete, we can pat ourselves on the back a little bit, because I checked out the plant-based milk fridge at the supermarket this morning, and just 1 foot of space is going to the soy milk. All the rest is oat milk and almond milk and everything, and many, many different brands. There's one brand of soy milk, and it was literally 1 foot of shelf space. So the consumer has figured out, and largely because of the work the Weston A. Price Foundation has done, that soy is a really toxic plant.
Right. Well, I think what they have in common, though, is just that they're trying to undercut people. They've traditionally done business with the dairy farmers, and then the cattle farmers.
So, right.
Yeah. And so another way they've, well, I guess one last question on the cell cultured meat. So I think you've actually looked into, or at least I think there are around 50 producers.
Producers is the wrong word, Pete, because they really haven't produced it yet. It's a huge boondoggle, I think, and it's a way to separate dot-com millionaires from their money. And there's been a huge investment in all of these various labs. It's very prestigious for universities to be doing this work. A lot of these labs are centered in universities.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of grant money available for
grant
this.
Money and millionaire money, and
if I were
an advisor to a dot-com millionaire, I would say I don't think this is a very good investment.
Right. And you know, it all boils down to taste too. Have they actually done any surveys with potential consumers?
They have, and the taste is described as metallic. And they've had, little tastings, and it doesn't come out well.
Okay, you mentioned we were just talking about the plant-based milks. There are also some plant-based meats out there. Namely the two ones that seem to get the most attention are the Impossible Burger and the Beyond Burger. So if you could,
All right, and Beyond, they're saying Beyond because this is beyond the original veggie burgers, which were tasteless pucks and, you know, very hard to eat. And these resemble meat a lot more. And one of them, I believe it's the Impossible Burger, has something called legume hemagglutinin in it, which makes it look like it's bleeding. So they look a lot more like meat, and they're sold in the meat department. But again, you've got tons of additives to these burgers, and the most concerning to me is the flavorings, because to get a meat-like flavor, you have to add some form of MSG. Now, they don't say MSG on the package, but it'll be, hydrolyzed protein of some kind, or, you know, citric acid, any of these things that will provide a meat-like flavor. And that's MSG. MSG rushes into the bloodstream. It's not like glutamic acid, which is released slowly into the bloodstream, and there's a lot of checks and balances to make sure it doesn't overstimulate the nervous system, but that's not true of MSG.
So I think the Impossible Burger has been around for like 3 or 4 years. What kind of demand do you see for that?
Yeah, I would really be interested to know. You know, there was this huge publicity push. I mean, these people must have spent millions on publicity. Articles in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, things come up on the internet. I always look, and when I'm in the store, to see if anybody's choosing this stuff, and I don't ever see anybody take it from the case. But the both of these, as I said, are made from legumes. The Beyond Burger is made from lentils, and the Impossible Burger is made from genetically modified soy. So these will, it will be absolutely loaded with glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup. And we're now really learning about the problems with glyphosate. They really are horrendous. And even the Beyond Burger, I believe it's organic lentils, but these crops are often sprayed with Roundup as a desiccant just before harvest. So there's a lot of Roundup in these fake burgers. And isoflavones, plant-based estrogens, they will be in the Impossible Burger. Even a feedlot cow getting hormone implants has just a fraction of the estrogens in it that an Impossible Burger does.
One of the more interesting things I saw was that the CEO of this Impossible Burgers, his goal is to eliminate all all food products made from animals in the next 15 years.
Yeah, that's Pat Brown. He says that by 2030, his goal is to see the complete elimination of animal products. You can be assured that's just for you and me. That's not for the millionaires who are putting money into this. They'll still get their filet mignon.
Right. Just another area we've seen movement on recently is the Archer Daniels Midland has built a big plant to manufacture insects for animal feed. But at this conference, this latest food safety conference, there was also a speaker who talked about meat substitutes. And, you know, it seemed like he was talking for human consumption. And he mentioned mealworms, ants, and termites as substitutes for meat. So what do you know? Is there any kind of broader push you know of to...
Pete, I'm not as familiar with how this is raised and processed. In many traditional diets, insects are a substitute for meat, and they are the only animal food in the diet. Now, these people who eat insects are not particularly robust compared to those eating meat. But it is, you know, insects are an important traditional food, as much as we would not want to eat them. Now, to make insects palatable to humans, I don't know what would be involved, but certainly a lot of flavorings. And who knows what kind of chemicals they are using in the raising of these insects. We just don't know. So we would really have to see some flow charts. By the way, the anyone who has a shellfish allergy would not want to eat insects because it will carry the same allergenic proteins.
Okay. So you've got all these substitutes for traditional meat, but there are plenty of problems with the conventional meat supply out there as well. Just one of the purposes of this podcast is to get people to consider going to the farm, especially for meat, poultry, and eggs. But one move that looks like it's underway is USDA is no longer going to be requiring, I don't know if it's a done deal yet, but it's the direction they're moving in, no longer requiring disclosure if meat or poultry has been irradiated. And I think what happened, you know, there may be between 20 and 30 million pounds of meat that are just thrown out for a year because of positive pathogen tests. So this might be their way of, trying to save money in that area by having this kill step. But the problem is they have worked, you know, this has been around, I think, for at least 15 or 20 years. They have been working, they have had surveys on this. I looked at one of the old surveys. It's people complained of the burnt taste. Someone said the irradiated meat tasted like singed hair. So they've got some problems in the taste department. But it's just, so that's one labeling deception out there. But I know, you've written about some other things that aren't exactly on the up and up, like with the use of antibiotics and just these country of origin labeling laws, especially meat coming from China. So, could you tell the viewers about that?
We really know less and less about our meat, what's in it, and where it comes from. The industry has fiercely resisted country of origin labeling. And I think most Americans would prefer to know that their meat came from America. But even American meat is fraught with problems. One of the ones I wrote about was arsenic. So about 70% of all chicken feed has arsenic added to it. And the chicken's getting a little bit of arsenic every day. This is often used in chickens that are antibiotic free. So just we really need to be careful. Then there's the use of chlorine when the chickens are slaughtered. That's not on the label. Ractopine, which is given to hogs to make them grow rapidly, and it favors the production of lean meat. So we're getting, lean bacon, which is an oxymoron. this additive is banned in Europe. All European countries have banned it, but it's still allowed in the United States.
What did they say some of the side effects or the health effects of ractopine are?
One of them was cancer. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't remember what the others were. But, our meat is getting more and more dodgy, and it's really a shame because America, 50 years ago was famous for its beef. And now it doesn't taste good. The pork, you can smell the misery in those pigs. And as you say, this is a really important reason to buy your meat directly from a farmer whom you know and who is raising these animals humanely and without all these chemicals.
Isn't there something too with the poultry and avian leukosis? Could you explain what the USDA rules are?
Well, if a chicken comes through the line and it has a tumor or some yucky part to it, they throw that away, but they still sell the rest of the chicken. So they would cut it up and you'd get the thighs and the breasts and everything of this chicken that probably had some awful disease. It could be avian leukosis, it could be something else. And this is one reason we say you never buy anything but a whole chicken, never buy chicken parts. I mean, if you are, if that is your only alternative is the supermarket, you never buy parts in the supermarket. Because at least you know that that whole chicken didn't have disease in it.
So if you're buying chicken, conventional chicken from the market, chances are pretty good if you're buying the parts.
That yes, that the there was a part of the chicken that wasn't healthy, had a tumor or whatever.
All right. Well, that's, hopefully we've discouraged people on the meat from buying from the supermarket. Well, I want to go on to some of these synthetic ingredients. So one you've already mentioned, but definitely deserves a longer look because it's all over the food supply is monosodium glutamate, MSG. So can you talk about what exactly is in it and what it does?
Right. So glutamic acid is an essential amino acid. We need it. It's very important for the nervous system, for the firing of the nerves and the synapses. But as I said, when you eat foods containing glutamate, natural glutamate, this amino acid is in a complex with a lot of peptides and things, and your body has to break that down. And there's also all kinds of feedback loops to make sure that this glutamate is released slowly and properly into the bloodstream so it can't overstimulate the nerve, so you don't get this rapid firing of the nerve cells. MSG is sort of like eating sugar compared to maple syrup. In other words, it goes right into the bloodstream. There's nothing to stop it, and you get the rapid firing of the nerves, and that can cause all kinds of problems, behavior problems. It can, it's associated with Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, all of these nervous disorders, and it can cause rapid changes in blood pressure. I know people who pass out if they eat a meal that has MSG in it. And the really sad thing is, it's hard to know whether the meal, the food that you're buying, has it in it because it's usually not labeled. At your suggestion, I looked at a can of Old Bay seasoning, Pete, which is used on almost all seafood. I mean, if you buy shrimp in a restaurant, it's going to have Old Bay on it. And one of the ingredients is spices. Well, what they do is buy these spice mixtures, and if they're less than 50% MSG, they don't have to put it on the label. So hiding in that word spices will be the MSG.
And there's, I think you have that on your website, right? I think you've done stories before on the different labeling terms that can be used for MSG.
Anything autolyzed, hydrolyzed, the caseinates, autolyzed yeast, these are all substitute terms for MSG. And also in this, things like soy, which has a lot of natural glutamate in it, they don't even have to label it, but it will be there after the processing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I went to this area of the city I live with, a lower income area, and it was, like you say, usually when you go to a supermarket, you're not going to see too many foods labeled with MSG. But actually in this area, one of the lower income areas, there were just a number of foods. It was more out front than you typically see going into a supermarket. So I guess
I do see it on, so we live in Southern Maryland, and there's some typical foods like scrapple and sausage, of course. And you do see MSG on the labels of those foods. So it's,
right.
I don't think they have to hide anything. So.
And when people, the apologists for MSG talking, you mentioned this a little earlier, but start talking about, glutamic acid, your body produces that anyway. It's just something
you need it. You get it in other foods, yes.
Yeah. So what's the difference between the other foods and MSG?
Well, when it's, glutamic acid is in very flavorful foods. It is in meat. It's in fermented foods. It's in cheese. And but in these cases it's in a complex, and the body breaks it down slowly, and it's released slowly into the bloodstream, and that's not the case with MSG.
Right.
And, you know, they couldn't sell these foods without MSG because they don't taste good. They don't taste like anything unless they put MSG in it. And when you get to these plant-based meats, they are just going to be loaded with some form of MSG.
Right. Yeah, I just, the book Fast Food Nation actually had a, I think it's chapter about this place off the New Jersey Turnpike that was manufacturing all these meat tasting, you know, right, meat-like substances.
And they'll have other compounds in them, but the main one will be MSG.
Right. All right. Well, on to another big one, which is aspartame. Just from what I understand, the FDA has received more complaints about aspartame than any other food ingredient. It's not close for a second.
And it's very toxic. It breaks down into formaldehyde and methyl alcohol in the gut. So, and both of these are very toxic. They're complete poisons. Aspartame does tend to be addictive. I know people who are so addicted to it that they have to put one package of Sweet and Low in their mouth after another. Not Sweet and Low, but Equal. And it is in foods that aren't labeled. I know that it's allowed to be added to certain types of yogurt. And I would just be careful of any diet food or any food they say is low in sugar, because they are going to be substituting an artificial sweetener, usually aspartame, but also sucralose.
So there are labeling exemptions for the producers of aspartame.
Yes, there are.
Yeah, it's amazing they haven't tried to. I know people have tried to get it off the market for years, but it's still around. Another big one that's...
And by the way, Pete, the aspartame should never have been approved. The FDA did not want to approve it. You may remember.
Right.
Refused to approve it. And then Donald Rumsfeld, when he came into power, he changed a few people over at the agency and he just browbeat them into approving it. And
right.
So
well,
all the side effects are often referred to as Rumsfeld's disease.
That's right. Right. Yeah. And I... Yeah, the last time I looked, there were 92 of them, 92 different diseases that could come from consumption of aspartame. Right. Another big one that's grown, unfortunately, in use the past couple generations is high fructose corn syrup. What can you tell us about that?
Well, this is it's kind of an interesting history. You may remember that they used to make margarine out of corn oil margarine. And then they came up with a new hydrogenation process, and the soybean oil worked better for hydrogenation than the corn oil. And that's really when the soybean oil came into its own. And 80% of all edible oils today are soybean oil. So it's a huge and powerful industry. So now the question was, what are you going to do with all this corn? Because you weren't making margarine out of it anymore. And they came up with the process to make high fructose corn syrup, which basically is a fermentation process that transforms the glucose in corn into fructose. And the way it was explained to me is that the fructose that you end up with is actually just a little bit different from the fructose in plant foods and fruit and so forth. And the body cannot use it in the Krebs cycle. So the body cannot use it for energy, and it either goes into the blood, causing high triglycerides, or it goes into your fat cells. So it's kind of a fast road to gaining weight.
Are there any labeling deceptions with high fructose corn syrup? Or is that the way it always is on the label?
I have not heard of any, although I often wonder when I see corn sweetener on a label, if that's not high fructose corn syrup, because after all, high fructose corn syrup is a dirty word today, and most people know that it's bad stuff. It is one of the articles with the highest traffic on our website is the high fructose corn syrup article. So I do think there's probably a great temptation to call it something else. And as I say, I'm always suspicious when I see corn sweetener on a label.
Hasn't it been linked with a tremendous increase in diabetes?
Yes, well, certainly in obesity. Because that's right. Your body really can't use it, and so it just tucks it away in the fat cells.
Right, yeah. And there's another synthetic ingredient you've written about lately called modified food starch, which seems to be increasing in popularity among the manufacturers. If you could speak about that.
So they use modified food starch to give certain qualities to food. Just for example, like a tortilla shell to keep it crisp and holding its shape, they use modified food starch, or to get a certain thickness in a sauce, in a prepared meal or whatever. And we actually, Marinda Teller and I, working on this article, couldn't find much about modified food starch. What I do know is that it's almost all of it's produced in China, and they have these conferences where people come and pick out the modified food starch that they want for their various foods. I'm certain that modified food starch is very difficult to digest, because what they've done is make it difficult to digest. They've given it staying power. They've made it so it doesn't break down. So you're not gonna be able to break this down either. So I would imagine that modified food starch contributes to a whole bunch of digestive problems.
How long has it been around, Sally?
That I don't know, but I would say for years. I
mean, okay.
One of those ingredients that's just ubiquitous in the food supply.
Okay, so our next ingredient is something Weston Price has devoted a lot of time to, and successfully as well, and that would be soy. So if you could talk about that.
We had just been founded when the big push for soy came out, and this was going to be this wonderful food that made you healthy, it made you lose weight, and they just made incredible claims for these soy-based foods. So you basically have two types of soy-based foods. You have foods based on soy protein, and the protein has been manipulated using high heat and chemicals to take out the bitter taste and to make it somewhat palatable. And they say to get rid of all of the toxins in the soy. And soy is an extremely toxic legume. But to get rid of all the toxins, they have to also completely destroy the protein. So it's kind of a balance there. And then the other soy ingredient is the soybean oil, which is rancid from the beginning. One of the problems with soybeans is they're very high in isoflavones, which is a plant type of estrogen that causes endocrine disruption in the humans or animals that eat it, and also causes thyroid problems. And it's a fat-soluble substance, so it's going to be in the oil, and that soybean oil is in everything.
If you could talk about the Illinois prison case, or cases Weston Price worked with for years.
This has been a very frustrating case for us. We were contacted by prisoners in 2003. In 2003, Blagojevich became governor of Illinois, and he had a big debt to Archer Daniels Midlands. And the first thing he did was fire the food service director for the prisons, an African-American woman who really cared about the prisoners and made sure that the food tasted good and so forth. And they fired her, and they bought all this soy protein, and all of a sudden the meals were all soy. There was no meat. There were these soy nuggets, soy sausages, soy sausage patties. They were adding soy to the baked goods. And suddenly these men started to suffer from horrendous health problems. Digestive problems, everything from horrible, painful constipation to debilitating bloody diarrhea. Endocrine problems, many of them developed breasts, and then the thyroid problems. And our friend in the Illinois prisons tells us virtually all the men in the prison have serious thyroid problems, and they will be on disability when they get out of prison. They won't be able to work. So what happened was we actually went to court to try to get an injunction against serving the soy. We were not successful. This is a very powerful industry, and we were not successful. But when the Blagojevich left in 2019, January of 2019, they started serving meat again, and they got rid of the soy. Unfortunately, it didn't last. As of about 3 months ago, they're now not serving meat to the prisoners and only serving soy. And what's made this really hard for them is they've limited the amount they can buy in the commissary. So they either have to poison themselves with the soy or starve. So this has been a very tragic and frustrating situation for us. And the reason for it, Pete, is that soy is not selling well to people who are not in prison, you know. People figured out that soy is bad. They had hoped, I think it was by in 2010, to have $8 billion in sales per year, and it only came to $4 billion, and it just didn't budge after that. So what they started to do was sell it to institutions.
Right. Well, I think one of the major successes Weston Price had, one time wasn't soy a big part of this protein powder industry, and hasn't that declined quite a bit?
Yes. And, you know, it was big. It was promoted in the bodybuilding crowd and the people who went to gyms. And right. It made them very flatulent. And the gyms started to really stink. And people stopped using it when they found out that it was coming from the soy. But you can imagine in a prison what happens.
Yeah, well,
fights have broken out.
It's definitely an Eighth Amendment violation. That isn't cruel and unusual punishment.
Yeah. So right. I mean, it's really not funny. But so soy has, not reached what they had hoped. And it serves them right. Soy is toxic. It's always been recognized as a toxic plant. We shouldn't be growing all this soy. We shouldn't be making soybean oil. We shouldn't be using it. I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime, but I look forward to the day when we do not raise soy anymore in this country.
You mentioned the use of soy as a vegetable oil earlier too, but there are a lot of other vegetable oils that are harmful as well, I think. So I know you've done one of your more popular lectures has been on one called The Oiling of America.
And that's what's happened. So I call these industrial seed oils, euphemistically called vegetable oils. And these were not in the human diet before 1890. That's when the press was invented. Really not before about 1910, because when they squeezed the oil out of these seeds, whether it's cottonseed, corn, soybeans, it looks like an industrial gunk. It's brown and smelly, and it took a lot of research, so to speak, to figure out how to clean up these oils. And they add a little bit of yellow coloring, so you think of butter, and add flavorings and antioxidants. And so that took a while, but starting in about 1912 was the real push to get Americans to use vegetable oils, either liquid or partially hydrogenated. And they did it by demonizing the competition, which is butter and lard. And they made it seem like it was sort of vulgar to cook with lard. And lard is an extremely healthy, important fat to have in our diet. And that you should feel guilty if you use butter. And I can't tell you how many people have told me I had to get over my sense of guilt before I would allow myself to eat butter again. So it was an extremely successful marketing campaign, and what they did was get the medical profession to do the marketing for them, to get the guys in white coats to tell you that saturated fat caused heart disease and that you should use these wonderful vegetable oils instead. I can't stress enough that they are completely new to the human diet. They are a form of fat, polyunsaturated fat, that rapidly goes rancid either before or after you eat it. breaks down in the body into aldehydes. These are small, very damaging molecules. And it causes an extreme disruption and imbalance on the cellular level, because you need a lot of saturated fats for your cells to work properly. When the body only has polyunsaturated fats, the cells are not, they don't maintain their integrity. They become leaky and floppy, and, you know, just all kinds of problems can ensue from that.
The what vegetable oils does Weston Price recommend?
Well, we recommend basically the fruit oils, which have traditionally been consumed by human beings because they're easy to remove from the fruit, and they don't look disgusting or they don't smell bad. So olives, of course, are a fruit, very oily fruit, and it's easy to extract the oil. Coconut is a fruit, very oily fruit. It's easy to extract the oil. Palm fruit is sort of like an oily date in the palm tree. And these have been used since time immemorial. There are two very oily seeds that were used traditionally. One is sesame seed, and it was extracted with stone presses right on the spot and used right on the spot, because it too can go rancid. And the other one was rapeseed. And it was recognized that if people ate too much rapeseed oil, that they would get things like heart problems, and it would not be good for them. But what's being used today are, you cannot extract the oils with a stone press, so it was never done. You need a stainless steel press for this.
Talk about canola oil too, because that's been one that you see that in health food stores all the time.
Right. Well, the industry recognized that they had a problem. They recognized that soybean oil and corn oil and cottonseed oil were very unsafe. And the studies were showing that more and more, that they were unstable. So they came up with canola oil. It was actually the manipulated seed, not like today's genetic modification, but it was a manipulated seed from the rapeseed. And of course, they weren't going to call it rapeseed oil. That wouldn't sell very well. So they called it canola oil, named after Canada, because it grows very well in Canada. And this was going to be the ideal heart-healthy oil. It was very high in monounsaturates like olive oil, and it had some omega-3 in it, and that was, you know, the new buzzword was omega-3s, and very, very low in saturated fat. But when they fed this, oil to test animals, they developed heart lesions just like the rapeseed oil caused. So, and the big concern in canola oil is the omega-3, because it goes rancid so quickly.
Right. Yeah, it's just amazing the marketing on these things.
You know, really the only oil we should be using in the Western kitchen is olive oil, real olive oil. And you use that to make your salad dressing, but you want to cook in animal fats. Butter, lard, tallow, duck fat, goose fat, for many reasons, but one of which is that they're very stable and they don't break down under heat. And the other reason, of course, is that they carry the fat-soluble vitamins A, D, and K, which you can't get anywhere else except in animal fats and organ meats.
Right. The let's go on to another product that is unfortunately subject to all kinds of manufacturing, and that would be just conventional milk and conventional milk products. You were telling me, we'll start off with one of the biggest eye openers, which would be ice cream. If you could talk about the term industry standards and what's actually in our ice cream and why it's not on the label.
No, if you've ever made homemade ice cream, you know that when you take it out of the freezer, it's really hard. You have to wait for it to soften before you can even spoon into it. But when you buy ice cream at a store, you can dip your spoon into it right away when you take it out of the freezer. And that's because store-bought ice cream contains a type of antifreeze, propylene glycol, which is approved for food use, but it is antifreeze. And antifreeze is very toxic to the kidneys, and causes the buildup of crystals little crystals in the kidneys. And they do not have to label this because it is an industry standard. And what I've noticed is that the more expensive the ice cream, the easier it is to dip into it because of they're using the antifreeze.
It's amazing.
By the way, I always tell people who have kidney problems, and you don't see a lot written about how to avoid kidney problems. The first thing I say is stop eating ice cream. And then I say stop using microwave food because the microwave creates kidney toxins.
So you think it's in all ice cream in the supermarket if someone...
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. This industry standard, is there another example you know of where that...
Yes. In fact, I found a really interesting article last night after we had our talk about unlabeled ingredients. And one of them is aluminum. There's several different types of aluminum salts that they add to things like processed cheese. And it is not on the label. They don't have to put it on the label.
Yeah, which brings up another label deception with dairy. It's a cheesemaker, you'd know this very well, and that is with raw cheese that's often sold in the supermarket. It's not really raw, is it?
Not really raw. So the temperature for pasteurization, I believe it's 160 degrees Fahrenheit. But if they heated it up to, say, just 150 degrees, the FDA allows them to call that raw, but it's not raw because over 110 degrees, the enzymes are destroyed. So it's not raw. And in Europe, they have to label that as thermized. But here they can call it raw. So in our shopping guide, for example, we contact every cheesemaker and ask them, what temperature do you heat your milk to for making cheese? And it really should not go over 110. Actually, we stick to 105 when we make cheese. We do not go over 105. So that's a real deception in the cheese. Another one that we talked about was in skim milk. They add powdered skim milk to the skim milk to give it body, to give it heft. And powdered skim milk can be labeled as milk. So they don't have to say that it's powdered when they add it to the skim milk. And there was a recent study in China where they looked at different ways of processing milk. And they found that even powdering, even freeze drying caused a very serious degradation of the milk proteins. So in the skim milk, not only are you not getting the fats that you need with the milk, but you're also getting all these degraded proteins in the powdered skim milk that they're adding.
There's an interesting comment on a blog you had about that, I think, where someone was saying that with a skim milk, they have to add back the vitamin A and vitamin D. And when they're adding them back, included with that was MSG.
Yes, apparently in the way they manufacture the vitamin D, MSG is formed. It's also in the powdered milk. So this powdering process will take the glutamic acid and separate it from its complex so that it acts like MSG. And I can't stress enough, MSG is addictive. And of course they want our food, they want these processed foods to be addictive. Right. And we've talked also, Pete, about the dangers of eating a lot of protein without the fat. Nature and every species of mammal puts fat in there, sometimes lots and lots of fat. And that's because fat is the butter fat is the fat in nature that's required for the growth and development of all mammals, including humans. And it's also very important to always have these fat-soluble vitamins with your protein because they're needed to process the protein. And anytime milk to me is a sacred food. It is a perfect food. It's a very delicate food. It is a healing food. It's a food for growth and development. And when we start to treat it as an industry product, it's to me, it's a sacrilege. It's taking something, you know, blessed by the gods and turning it into something that's quite toxic. And then we expect our children to grow up normal and healthy on this processed milk.
I think as time has gone on, the industry's mantra used to be milk is milk. It doesn't matter whether it's raw or pasteurized, but as time has gone on, I think people, more and more people are grabbing on to the fact that there is a difference between milk for pasteurization and milk for direct consumption.
And the main thing is that a lot of people can't drink pasteurized milk. It's highly allergenic. It gives them a stomach ache. If milk gives your child a stomach ache, you're not going to give it to the child, of course. And, you know, they spent $1 for every person in California in their milk mustache campaign in California. And the milk consumption just steadily went down. You know, it just people, it's toxic and people can't drink it anymore. So, and I have brought this up. I was at a meeting. It was a Farm Bureau meeting where they were saying, you know, milk consumption is going down. What do we do? It's because of the competition with the plant-based milks. And I raised my little hand and I said, no, it's because it's allergenic. When you pasteurize milk, it becomes allergenic. And they just don't want to hear that. There was an embarrassed silence in the room when I said this.
Well, that's why they're having to market these toxic flavored milks to the kids too, because it's the only way they'll drink it.
So what the industry has figured out is that there's a lot more money to be made from the butterfat in milk if they put that in ice cream or whipped cream. And they don't want to waste the profits from the fat on growing children, for heaven's sake. So they have created this big campaign to make it illegal to give full fat milk to children. And most of the milk in the schools is actually skim milk. The kids hate it. To me, this is just the most glaring example I can think of what's wrong with food processing, because the profits are in ruining the food. And so these flavored milks are skim milk, powdered skim milk, a sweetener, usually high fructose corn syrup, and additives, okay? And the strawberry milk, for example, doesn't even have strawberries in it. And so there's no goodness in this milk at all. And skim milk, the USDA years ago did a study to see how to fatten pigs, what the best way of fattening pigs was. And when they gave them whole milk, they didn't get fat. You know, a thing that made them fat was skim milk. And the pig is very much like the human being in its digestive tract. And here we're decrying the obesity epidemic in our children, but we're giving them the very thing that will make them fat. And that's skim milk with a lot of sugar in it.
Right. Okay. You told me you were going to make a trip to the supermarket this morning, and one of the things you were going to look at was the labeling on seafood. I mean, just part of this program.
Unfortunately, I couldn't find any.
Okay.
I couldn't find any wild seafood, and they had like Nature's Promise seafood there, and it was just frozen seafood. Now, I don't know if there's for a bleacher, something in it that is not being labeled, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. One thing at this last food safety conference, when the USDA official was talking about irradiating meat and poultry and not putting it on the label, not disclosing that on the label, they did indicate that FDA was looking at something similar for irradiating seafood and some produce.
Yeah.
So stay tuned.
And well, you know, I think they just passed a law in Australia, or they just started to do this. All produce is irradiated. Fruit and vegetables in Australia.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to be going there anytime soon. Okay. Just finishing up with a couple things that unfortunately are increasingly in the food supply. You mentioned glyphosate earlier. Could you talk about the food that's been found in and just the health
impact? So glyphosate is the major ingredient in the herbicide Roundup. And they always have assured us that glyphosate has no effects on human beings. And now we realize that it does have effects on human beings in two ways. First of all, it kills our gut flora. And we know that we are absolutely dependent on healthy gut flora to digest our food, to keep toxins out, to produce feel-good chemicals, to do all kinds of things. So the glyphosate, you know, when they started making this claim, we hadn't realized how important the gut flora was. And now we do. But secondly, the glyphosate, it was glycine and phosphorus compound. When it gets into your body, it substitutes for glycine. And just for example, let's just say you have an enzyme that has glycine in it. When the glyphosate takes its place, then the enzyme won't work. And there's all sorts of pathways that depend on glycine in the body that are not going to work if you're eating a lot of glyphosate. And the amount in the food is increasing. A number of years ago, and it wasn't that long ago, they started using it as a desiccant for things like wheat, oats, lentils, soybeans, and they spray it just a day or two before harvest to dry out the stems and everything. So you're going to get a really big dose of glyphosate. To me, the most serious problem is wheat. So we urge people, make sure the wheat and the wheat products that you're eating are organic, because otherwise there's going to be a big dose of glyphosate.
Yeah, speaking of wheat, what is your opinion just on this explosion in gluten intolerance?
Well, Stephanie Senoff, who's really been the one who is beating the drum on this, and by the way, is coming out with a wonderful book called Toxic Legacy, she believes that the gluten intolerance is largely due to the glyphosate, and we have seen a big increase, parallel increase. And she also believes that glyphosate plays an extremely large role in autism, in causing autism. And she can explain, it gets quite complicated with all the chemistry, but
right.
It's partly the destruction of the gut flora, but there's other reasons that glyphosate will, contribute to autism for sure.
There's another, I guess, additive that's increasingly showing up in our food called nanoparticles. And I was looking on FDA's website, and there's really no pre-market approval for adding that as an ingredient. They recommend you contact them, tell them what you're putting in it, but there's no requirement on that. And just what, there really hasn't been a lot of, as much media about it as there should be.
No, because they don't want an outcry. So nanoparticles are extremely small. If a blood cell is the size of a football field, the nanoparticle is the size of a football. They're extremely small, and because of the very large surface to volume ratio, they behave differently than a regular substance. Mm-hmm. So they don't behave the same, and they really are showing up in lots of foods. They are used to give certain textures, certain staying power. The most common one is, I believe it's zinc oxide. And then there's a calcium one too. And they're adding I think about 25% of all baby formula contains nanoparticles. So they're adding the calcium, not as a calcium powder or anything, but as these nanoparticles. I mean, they're the size of viruses. You cannot see them with a microscope, regular microscope. You have to use an electron microscope to see them. And we have no idea what effects they could have or how they behave physically and chemically in the body.
Are they attributing any specific health problems to them yet, or is it still too early on?
Yeah, I just don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, because we both read this story in France on how many food products over there have nanoparticles, and I think it was something like 900.
Yes, it was, 10 or 15% of the food supply.
Yeah, and over 4,000 are suspected of having it.
Yes.
So it just seems like a real problem down the road.
Yeah.
But anyway, what you like to say is you never talk about a problem without bringing up a solution.
Yes.
So we've talked about all these health troubles with the synthetic foods. What's your antidote?
So with your help, Pete, the Weston A. Price Foundation has launched what we call the 50% Pledge. We ask everyone to take the 50% pledge, which would be to buy 50% of your food dollar directly from local farmers and artisans whom you know, and whom you know what they're doing with their animals and how they produce their food. With that other 50%, you can celebrate how small the world has become. We're not asking you not to eat pineapples or rice or bananas, things that are only available in modern times to us. But again, you need to be very careful when you buy these other foods. They should be organic, you need to know where they come from, and don't buy a food with a label, okay? Don't buy a food that's packaged and prepared. I think it's important for people to learn how to cook. But again, getting back to the 50%, we really want to support these farmers. This is true food security. And the good news is, as our food supply gets worse and worse, we have more and more farmers raising food the way we want. We can find them through our website, realmilk.com, through the local chapters of the Weston A. Price Foundation. We have a saying, who's your farmer? Everyone needs to have a farmer.
Just one of the few good things to come out of the COVID crisis is this last year is it seems like more and more people are going to the farm.
Yes, yes. The income from grass-based, non-toxic farmers has gone up. And from artisans too, people making sauerkraut, sourdough bread, kombucha, broth. People realize the importance of these foods.
Right. And just the legislators, at least at the state level, are starting to realize the importance too. Just about every state has a cottage food law facilitating the direct sale from producer to consumer. You know, a handful of states have tried to expand that into foods not traditionally known as cottage foods. It might be poultry in some cases, some other, say, fermented vegetable products, which wouldn't be found to be your typical cottage food. So
we're really heading for two food systems. We have the industrial food system, which is fraught with problems. And you know, an industrial food, the goal is not to make you healthy. The goal is for them to make money on this food and to make you crave the food. And so we have the one stream is the industrial stream, but we have a growing, vibrant, local food system. Grows every year, more and more people go into farming. It's easier and easier to find these people with the internet. So let's take advantage of that. And, it's actually quite easy to eat a really healthy diet today. Certainly it's easier today than it was 20 years ago.
Right. And just from these food conferences you've sent me to, you just realize what major problems the industrial system has. These regulators really have thankless jobs. If there's an outbreak of industrial food, you could be talking about a product, ingredients made in several countries. It's just very hard to trace.
It's very hard to trace where it comes from. It's harder and harder to keep this food supply safe. And I'll tell you that I remember we had an inspector on our dairy who just went on and on about they were building a dairy for 48,000 cows in Texas. He said, how can the food be clean with, you know, that many cows?
Yeah. I was talking to someone two ago, who was explaining what he thought the dairy farmer of the future would be. And he goes, think of like a five-story parking garage. And you have cows on every story going up. So it's, people.
Well, you know, that's how they're doing vegetables today in Holland. And this is a good thing. They pretty much grow everything in greenhouses, and they've been able to really minimize the chemicals they use. They've kind of figured this out. The Dutch have been in great, and they've exported this system to many other countries. You know, we don't need to be completely pessimistic about this. There's some things that are much better today. And one is our access to fresh fruits and vegetables. We have far more vitamin C in our diet today than we did 100 years ago. Another is our access to salt. Salt was a rare commodity, 200 or 300 years ago, certainly 1,000 years ago. People fought wars over access to supplies of salt. And now everybody has salt. Of course, we recommend unrefined salt that doesn't have all the chemicals in it. By the way, there's another one they don't have to put on the label, that there's aluminum in the refined salt.
Yeah. Well, you're right that, this is actually, as the local food system gets bigger, I think there's going to be more and more access to healthy foods going on. And yeah, people are going to follow along closer to what Hippocrates said, let your food be your medicine, let your medicine be your food, because it just looks like, in addition to the conventional food system, the healthcare system is declined in reliability the last year.
Yes, yes. And frankly, the doctors have a thankless task. How do you make somebody healthy or even keep them alive when all they eat is industrial food?
Right. Well, they need to go to Weston Price University for their training on nutrition. That would be a big help. But all right, well, last thing, where can people go to find out more about Weston Price?
Okay, so our main website is westonaprice.org, and you'll see the 50% campaign, a link to it right on our banners, and what you can do to find healthy food. Please consider becoming a member and supporting the work we do, and members receive our quarterly journal. Our secondary website is realmilk.com, and you can find Real Milk where you live on this website, and also lots of other farms as well, plus tons of articles on the health and safety of raw milk. My own website is nourishingtraditions.com, and a lot of what we've talked about today are things that I've written about in my blogs.
Right. Okay. Well, Sally, it's been great. We'll post links to all these sites on the summary of the show when it's up on the Solaria website. And great to have you. Take care.
Thanks, Pete.